We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. WILLPLEDGE.ORG. Now here's your program.
Good morning. Welcome to Focus 580. This is our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. We're also very happy to have back once again on the program Jim Kaler. He's professor emeritus of astronomy at University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign, and over the years has been with us a number of times to talk about astronomy and to talk a little bit about what you can see in the sky at various times of the year. This morning, we will talk at least some about some of the things that you will find in his most recent book, and the title is Heaven's Touch, the subtitle From Killer Stars to the Seeds of Life, How We Are Connected to the Universe. It's published by the Princeton University Press. He's authored a number of books, and some of them are more technical than others. This is really a book, I think, for people who would say, I'm interested in learning some things about the cosmos, and I need to start at a fairly basic level. I think this would be a good book for you. Questions, of course, are welcome. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
You're welcome.
Do you remember the first time you ever looked through a telescope?
Golly. Might have been my own.
That you made?
Or was it yours? Probably around 10 years old or something like that. I can't remember exactly where I was. I remember my first look at the stars through binoculars and being amazed at the colors when I was 8 or 10.
I guess the only reason I ask the question is I know that you're one of those people who was bitten by the bug when you were
a
kid.
Yeah, it's pretty common in science. And it's pretty common in astronomy, too. Because everything's there to look at. You just walk out and look up, and there it is, you know, and at least that's what it used to be before the lights took over.
But
you can still see things. You can still see things.
Yeah.
Bright stuff.
Yeah. And if you get a chance to get someplace where the sky's dark, then it can be very dramatic. Yeah.
Even more so because you're not used to seeing what's there. And then you get out in the dark country sky and, oh, man, it's gorgeous.
It strikes me one of the things that you're encouraging people to think about in this book is, it's like this. Certainly we know that, as far as we know, forever people have been fascinated by what was going on in the sky, and for good reason, because it's very dramatic. And they saw things moving there, so they figured, they personified that. They figured something must be behind that. And then they said, well, that somehow what goes on there has to have some effect on us, on life on Earth. And what really strikes me is I think you're encouraging people with this book to think, well, yes, actually, not in that kind of a way, but that, yes, what happens in the sky elsewhere off of the Earth does, in fact, affect life on the Earth.
Yeah, we're not separated from what is out there. You feel a separation in a way when you stand outside in a clear night and look at the stars and you can't touch them, you can't get there. But the influences that they have on the Earth, even in short term periods, is pretty profound, and or at least can be pretty profound.
Yeah.
And this is an attempt to sort of bring it all together and just sort of integrate the universe with the Earth.
Well, give me a for example of some significant dramatic way that something far away that we cannot touch.
In the late 1980s, the sun released a huge blob of its outer corona called a coronal mass ejection. So when it would, during a peak of a solar cycle, slammed into the Earth, produced a tremendous aurora, which is what causes the northern lights in the first place, which generated currents on the ground and which regenerated currents in long-distance power lines, and the entire power grid of Quebec went out.
Pretty dramatic.
That's pretty dramatic. Perhaps one example. There's even some suggestions that subtle solar oscillations find their way into the stream of the solar wind that hits Earth, and it even affects cell phone communications. That's not proven yet, but still, it wouldn't surprise me in the least. The influences are so strong. When the sunspot cycle disappeared in the late 1600s, the Earth went into a little ice age. And we haven't seen sunspot. It's amazing. The sun has just gone completely quiet over the last year and a half. And people are speculating, hey, maybe this is going to happen again. Then probably not. It'll probably kick in just a little bit late. Mm-hmm. But we're dependent upon an awful lot of things. The exploding stars produce what are called cosmic rays. It's not radiation. It's particles, high-speed particles moving near the speed of light. They've been implicated in they slam into the Earth's upper atmosphere, produce the carbon-14 that archaeologists use to date ancient artifacts and fires and people and the like. They've been implicated in producing clouds, implicated in producing lightning, which, of course, is critical to life on Earth. Everything's connected with everything else.
Hmm. You know, I know that there are a lot of people who, on a variety of levels, are concerned about the fact that people don't feel connected to nature. And if it's something you don't feel connected to, well, you're not particularly going to care about taking care of it. Now, if it's a very immediate kind of a thing, if we say we're talking about the environment of the Earth, that's one thing. The environment of space, what happens out in space, it's not as if we could do anything to affect that, but... Is there? Do you think that it's also important for people to feel a connection with that?
Well, if it affects us, then we need be able to prepare for whatever the universe has in store for us. One example is asteroid collisions with the Earth. NASA has, and there are a variety of observing programs around the world to track down all the dangerous Earth-crossing asteroids, and their budgets have been cut. Apparently, some of the programs are being shut down. You can predict with a pretty good probability if one is going to hit sometime in the next 20, 30 years, and that gives you time to do something about it. If you got hit by a mile-wide asteroid or a two-mile-wide asteroid, it would be devastating to life on Earth. There's very good evidence that the dinosaurs were taken out by an asteroid strike 65 million years ago in a massive extinction that killed off something like 80% of the species alive at the time. And the evidence is quite strong for that. And there are ways actually of deflecting these things, given enough time. Or at least I'm sure we can think of ways of deflecting.
Well, and I think that a number of people have at least suggested ways that could be done. Nobody, I suppose, knows because we've never done it. We've never tried it. But I think the point is that the more heads up you have, the more time that you have to think about what you want to do.
You have to start someplace. Yeah. And one place is at least tracking them down and see what the dangers really are. What can you do about it? Well, you don't want to blow one up because that just produces sort of a shotgun effect rather than a slug effect. That could be even more dangerous. But I suppose you could plant a rocket on one of them. All you need to do is, if it's a 20-year timescale, inch it, move it over, just change it by a hair, and the perturbation grows and it'll miss us. One of the more innovative suggestions that I heard of was just go paint one side white, and the sun... It absorbs sunlight on one side and reflects it on the other, and that gradually changes its orbit.
Yeah, and I wonder the reaction of people. I'm not sure if the reaction is more fatalism. That is, they say, "Well, if it's going to happen, it's going to happen," or that people say, "Oh, well, that's not."
Let my kids worry about it.
Well,
right?
Yeah, either if it happens, it'll happen some other time. And I'm not sure, you know, as people, if you ask them, is this important, should we be spending money, whether more people would say, oh, that's whatever happens, or more people would say, I got more stuff to worry about.
That's probably true. It's the continuing argument of what are you going to spend your money on. It'd be still kind of nice to be able to prepare for something like that if it ever came to pass, and it will come to pass. And the Earth gets hit by hundreds of times per day by small asteroids called meteorites. They're landing on the ground constantly. The odds of one hitting you are minuscule, but it has happened on a rare occasion. But most of them are small, you know, baseball size, and most of them land in the ocean and they don't cause any problem. But there's a size range, and you don't want to get hit by one as big as a truck or... the one that took out the dinosaurs is estimated to be about 5 miles wide. Mm-hmm. And that produced apparently a global winter that just wreaked havoc on the worldwide.
Yeah. Just recently, I talked with somebody who wrote a book about meteorites and about particularly about people who became just obsessed with hunting them and collecting them.
It's a hobby, and it can be a lucrative one, too, I suppose, because there are people who there are meteorite vendors around various places around the world. You can find them on the web who gladly sell them to you. I bought a few. I got a small collection of half a dozen, which I use in classes. Two or three of them were given to me, and then I filled it in by buying some others from vendors. Mm-hmm. Small chips, but yeah. they serve. I mean, people are fascinated by them. Pick them, yeah. Touching something that came from space is 4.5 billion years old.
Well, that was what, as we talked about it. One of the questions I asked was, "Well, what's the scientific value?" And he said that precisely that.
Well, the scientific value is that you're getting a primitive body from before the planets formed. Yeah. And they help teach you how the planets formed and developed.
The other thing that I thought was interesting is that just how many meteorites every year strike the Earth. As you say, a lot of them either they land in the ocean or they land someplace.
Yeah, most of the Earth
is nowhere.
Unpopulated after all. And even if one landed within a mile of you, a small one, you wouldn't notice it because they don't come in with a great streak or crash. Most of the small ones hit terminal velocity, get slowed down by the Earth's atmosphere, and just basically fall to Earth rather silently. And it's only the really big ones that come slamming through.
Yeah. Two places, two places were some of the biggest places on Earth for finding meteorites. One is Antarctica,
yeah.
And the other was, I think, South Africa?
I'm not familiar with that one, but Antarctica, they get concentrated into the ice sheets, into the glaciers, and they're just pretty much there for the picking. So people go down there and collect them. For scientific reasons, tourists are – it's a bad place for tourists in the interior.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy here at University of Illinois. He's been here since 1964. His research area is dying stars. He's authored a number of books about astronomy, and his most recent is Heaven's Touch. It's the subtitle, From Killer Stars to the Seeds of Life, How We Are Connected to the Universe. Princeton University Press is the publisher. Questions are certainly welcome about astronomy and about the cosmos. You can give us a call. Jim will do his best to answer your question. 333-9455 and toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here in Chicago. Let's talk with them on our toll-free line. Hello.
Thank you. When you refer to the extinction of the dinosaurs, I understand, according to the geologists, that the occurrence resulted in the decrease of oxygen percentage that may have been 30 to 40% at that time, to like into the 20% range, and I was wondering if you had any thoughts on that, as well as another follow-up question.
I think I heard that once, but I'm not really that familiar with the oxygen decrease. What I have learned and read is that it produced so much dust and steam in the atmosphere that it pretty much blocked sunlight and killed off the bottom of the food chain.
Oh, yes.
Kill off the bottom of the food chain, guess what happens to the top of the food chain? So the evidence is pretty powerful. The meteorites and asteroids are high in the element iridium, and there's a layer of iridium-rich rock and clay around the world just about the time the dinosaurs disappeared. That was the first clue that something was going on. And they've even located what is most likely the crater, which is 100 to 200 miles wide off the coast of Mexico.
Another follow-up is another author wrote a book called Solar Rain, in which he stated the solar flares at what they go beyond what they call an X level create such a devastation at one time, as you referred to in Canada, ruining the system there electrically, and similarly may have occurred with the satellites too. So who knows what will happen when the next...
Coronal mass ejections can wreak havoc to satellites. Fortunately, most of the communications, most of them are inside the Earth's magnetic field. But you get them outside the Earth's magnetic field, anything out there, you got a problem. This is one of the real difficulties of sending astronauts to, say, Mars, even the moon, because they're out in the raw environment of space unprotected by the Earth's magnetic shield.
Another one one more final point regarding the flares from the sun. They have a great influence on the heating of the oceans, as I understand.
Well, I don't think anybody really has tracked down the physics of what is going on, but it's clear that when the sun is most active, when you've got a lot of spots, it radiates. The radiation level actually goes up, and in particular, the ultraviolet and X-ray radiation goes up. And the Earth's atmosphere actually expands, so it has a profound effect on it, but how that gets down to the ground is still pretty much unknown.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
All right, thank you. Other questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455 and toll free, 800-222-9455. The book, what you do is you talk about, I suppose you start here and then just move steadily outwards.
Yeah, there's an introduction of what the universe is, what it's about, the things that are in it, and I start with tides and move on to the solar storms and the sun and work my way out. We talk about ice ages and, what do the planets have to do with it? There's two beautiful planets out there now, three of them actually. In the early evening, you can see Jupiter over in the southwest, and Mars rises somewhat after midnight. And then in the morning, especially really getting darker now in the early morning hours as autumn approaches, Venus is just glorious around 5:30, 6 o'clock in the morning. And all of these planets affect the Earth's orbit and the Earth's movements, and they eventually have including the moon, and they eventually have effects apparently on the long-term climate. It's thought that these have produced ice ages in the past. So some of it's very slow, but it's there. All the influences, the cosmic influences, are out there.
Yeah. Venus really is.
And many of them are. The book and what I'm trying to do here is not focus on the scary stuff, although that's there, asteroid impacts, comet impacts, but on the benign and beneficial effects without which we wouldn't be here.
And that's not the kind of stuff that makes news, unfortunately. The meteorite or the asteroid that slams into Earth and brings an end to life as we know it. Now, that's news.
That's news. That's news.
Good stuff. That's not news. We have some callers here. Let's talk with some more folks. Urbana is next. Line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
I'm not sure if this is in your field of discussion this morning, but there's been some talk about the Earth polarity flipping. I believe it happens, about once every 50,000 years?
It's more like once every, the last number I saw was 700,000 to 100,000, 700,000 to a million years, or is it 100,000 years? It's something like that. It's in the hundreds. It's quite a long period, but there has been a decline in the Earth's magnetic field strength, I believe, over the last century. And there's some wonder, some speculation that we might be ready. We're about due for a magnetic field switch where the North Pole becomes the South Pole and vice versa. And that has to do with apparently with chaotic circulation in the liquid iron core of the Earth. It's been replicated mathematically that this sort of thing should happen on occasion. And it's clear that it does happen on magnetized rocks and spreading seabeds.
Mm-hmm.
There's some peculiarities. Apparently, the Earth can wind up with, say, two North Poles at the same time or without any magnetic field at all, which would be most interesting because then the solar wind just starts slamming right into the Earth's atmosphere. That could produce some interesting effects, interesting in the not-so-nice sense.
I take it this isn't catastrophic because we've gone through it in the past,
right,
and it didn't cause mass extinction.
Right. I think there's some speculation that it could cause increase in damage to life forms, but nothing all that dramatic. But in an era, a technological era like ours, where you've got a lot of satellites up there, the effects could be much more severe.
That's what I was wondering about.
And
the sun does this regularly, by the way. It flips every 11 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's part of the magnetic cycle. The polarities in the sun. You got a sunspot cycle where the spots come and go with an average of every 11 years, and at the peak they can be just really covered the sun. It's just a wonderful thing to watch.
Hmm.
And they're magnetized, so they tend to come in pairs where the leader spot in the rotation is one polarity and the follower another polarity, and then the other hemisphere is reversed. Then everything switches for the next 11 years.
Most interesting.
Yeah, it's a fascinating cycle, and apparently other stars do the same thing. There are signatures in the spectra of stars where you can follow this with others that at about a significant number, maybe half or two-thirds of the other stars that are like the Sun have similar sunspot cycles, magnetic cycles.
What about the large gaseous planets, Saturn and Jupiter?
That's not known. They have very strong. Jupiter has a very strong magnetic field, around 10 times that of the Earth. It's actually the Jupiter's magnetosphere is lethal to a human. You can't approach Jupiter too closely. Whether the fields switch or not is unknown. They can be very strange. The magnetic fields of Uranus and Neptune are wildly inclined to the rotation axis and don't even pass through the center of the planet. I mean, they miss by a huge amount. Nobody knows why.
Sounds like you scientists are going to have lots of fun for quite a few years.
We know so little. That's what makes this so much sport.
Well, thank you so
thank
much.
You.
You're welcome.
You're not going to run out of things.
No, you're not going to run out of things. Right. The more you look, the less you seem to understand.
What happens to a person if they would get too close to Jupiter?
Well, it's just a radiation bath
okay.
Because of the Jupiter's trapped, the particles trapped in Jupiter's magnetic field. It's not a very benign place. You'd have to get quite a ways away in one of the outer satellites, I think, to survive.
Very good. We'll talk next with someone in Belgium, Line 4. Hello.
Hello, and good morning to you all.
Good morning.
A couple of questions, example. One, there's some thought that that the Clovis people and some of the large animals in the North America were driven extinct by an impact on an ice sheet, the Cambrian ice sheet, many years ago, and caused the demise of that group of people. They were called the Clovis people, named after where they found the first artifacts in Clovis, New Mexico. That's another disastrous thing, but I wanted to really talk about an impact with the Earth that probably was extremely good for us. And way back in our history, something impacted us and put the moon around us. And our moon is very large in comparison to our size. I don't think any other planet has one that even comes close. And it's constantly moving a little bit farther away and a little bit farther away all the time. And obviously, at some point, it's going to no longer be with us. And wouldn't that really pose a real serious threat?
It will stay with us until the sun dies.
Oh.
So we don't have to. We've got to worry much more about the sun and the solar revolution than we do about the moon. The prevailing theory, which was developed over a long period of time, is that during the time of the formation of the planets, and this goes back 4.5 billion years, the primitive Earth, just as it was forming, got slammed by a competing planet, and which buried much of itself within the Earth, and the debris went into a disk around the Earth and reformed as the moon. It's the only explanation we have for the chemical composition of the moon. So it was a very early impact. And the moon becomes then very important to stability on Earth. There's a mathematical theory that suggests that the moon stabilizes the tilt of the Earth's axis. It's tipped at 23.5 degrees relative to the perpendicular to the orbit. And it's that tilt that gives you your seasons in the temperate zones. The 23.5-degree tilt puts the tropics of Capricorn and Cancer at 23.5 degrees latitude. It fixes the Arctic and the Antarctic Circle. And without the moon, there's strong suggestions that the Earth's axis would wobble, not the precessional wobble, but change the tilt angle, which would dramatically change the seasons on the Earth, which would be devastating to agriculture. Mars apparently does this, although it's never actually been observed. And the idea is that the moon provides a stabilizing force to keep that tilt very close within a degree or so.
By the gyroscopic action, I assume. The other item I wanted to think about, over all this period of time that we've been staring up at the skies and stuff, wouldn't something have hit the moon that we could have observed, though I don't ever hear anybody talk about it? You see lots of craters on the moon.
We have seen meteorites hit the moon. They can be seen during on the nighttime side of the moon, they have been seen during eclipses. It's a relatively rare thing because there's lots of craters, sure, on the moon, but it's an accumulation of 4.5 billion years, and most of them fell within the first billion and a half years when the planets were cleaning out the debris of the planetary system. It's called the heavy bombardment, but even then you wouldn't get a major impact but once every few thousand years or so. So it's a slow process, and it goes to the fact that the human mind can't really have appreciation for how big a billion really is.
I see. Well, thank you very much.
Right, you're welcome.
Thank you. Our guest this morning, this hour of Focus 580, is Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy at the University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign. He's authored many books, including the Cambridge Encyclopedia of Stars and the 100 Greatest Stars. And he is the author of a newly published book just out from Princeton University Press, the title Heaven's Touch, From Killer Stars to the Seeds of Life, How We Are Connected to the Universe. And as he said, sometimes, at least in the popular media, what we talk about when we talk about space are things like killer stars and asteroids hitting the Earth, things that would be very bad. He says he's encouraging people to think about all of the positive ways in which we are connected with the universe.
The book is funny, too.
It is.
At least I think it's funny. Well, it was written to be kind of funny.
I think it's really nicely written. And as I said before, I think it would be something where if you said, I'm interested in trying to learn some stuff about the cosmos, but I really don't know anything right now. And so you're starting out at a fairly basic kind of level.
Yeah.
It would give you a good tour. And then from then on, you know, maybe you'd want to look at some aspect.
We dig into things in some depth. It's the whole part of the whole point. But I tried to start it light and move ahead to some of the technical detail.
So you talked in one way about how life on Earth would be different if we didn't have the moon. Would there be life on Earth if we didn't have the moon?
Since we have no idea how life got started in the first place, or minimal ideas, I don't think anybody can answer that. There probably would be, but it would be there may well, because we're in an orbit where we can get liquid water, and that seems to be, at least that's everybody's guess, that that is what is required. No other planet can make that statement. Mars could at one point, but it didn't seem to last very long. Mm-hmm. And so far as we know, there's no life on Mars whatsoever. Never been found. And, you know, on Earth, it just leaps right out at you. You can't avoid it. Whether the moon was partly responsible for that is unknown. There's old suggestions that life started in tide pools, which is probably not correct. But, you know, that may have had an influence. The moon does certainly influence the oceans, no question about that. But without the moon, you'd have the sun doing kind of the same thing, but at about the one-third level.
So there would still be tides, but wouldn't be
dramatic. The sun produces about a quarter to a third of the ocean tide.
As people think about life and how it came about on Earth, I know that there are some people who suggest that maybe the constituent parts actually came from someplace else.
Panspermia, it's called, yes. And I don't know. Everybody can speculate. Anybody can speculate, but proving it is something very, very different. And there's no evidence of life forms in meteorites. There's amino acids in meteorites. That seems to be about as complicated as it gets.
Yeah.
But there's no evidence for life.
Well, I'm thinking not so much that actually life arrived from someplace, but that important pieces that you had to have came from someplace else.
The closest I've seen for explanations, I think it's this month's Scientific American has a nice article on it. It's either this month's or last month's on the origins of life and the modern thinkings. And whether any of that is true or not is, I suppose, anybody's guess.
Mm-hmm. Well, questions certainly are welcome. Folks want to call and ask questions about astronomy or about the cosmos, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. There are those people who argue that, you know, the universe is such a big place. We know that there are other planets that orbit stars. We've discovered some of them.
About 350 of them so far.
New ones all the time. And so it seems reasonable to think that someplace.
It certainly does.
Someplace.
It's a very common question. What do you think? What I think is, yeah, I think it's out there somewhere. But it's not making itself known to us. And grass doesn't talk and cows don't talk, and you know, whether there are people or anything like us out there is a somewhat separate question, but I would presume so. I mean, you're right, it's a big place, happened here. We tend to be a little provincial and assume that sometimes that we're the only ones. And uh, I I don't think so, but that's a speculation, and there's no evidence for it.
Yeah, and of course, there are people who argue that possibly within our solar system there would be living things. It's just that the technical challenges of going to look are pretty difficult.
There's a warm ocean underneath the ice, and the moon Europa, Jupiter's moon Europa, complements of tidal effects brought about by the other satellites. Titan, Saturn's big moon, is an amazing place. It rains. There's methane lakes and oceans. It rains methane. And trouble is, it's about minus 50 million degrees Fahrenheit. I mean, it's not all that far above absolute zero. It's a pretty cold place, which is why it rains methane. But it's eerily like the Earth, except it's just darn cold. And you know, maybe life could form under those circumstances. Nobody knows. You won't know until you get there with the proper robotic craft and take samples and bring them back and analyze them. Unless you can capture some critter running around trying to get his picture taken.
Probably not likely.
That hasn't happened.
Not yet. Yet. The depending on how you count in our solar system, we have 8 or 9 planets. Is there something about that number that's particularly significant?
No, I don't think so. I don't think there's any reason. The number of planets apparently has to do with the thickness of the density and the size of the disk out of which they formed, and they're all different around other stars. Some stars probably don't have planets at all. The preplanetary disk that created them got destroyed by companions or nearby passage. Some of them have extremely thick disks. There's a couple of stars where the disks are 10 times the thickness and the size of ours, which you'd assume then there were bunches of planets in them. Mm-hmm. So there's no particular fixed rule.
It must have something to do with the ability of the sun or whatever star the planets orbit to hold them.
Well, the planets are the sun's moons. Maybe it's a different way of looking at it. They're the sun's satellites. Uh-huh. The satellites of Jupiter are Jupiter's planets, in a way. You get a body forming out of – it has happened apparently with the sun because we see this phenomenon going on elsewhere. The sun apparently formed out of a collapsing blob of interstellar material. And as it collapsed, it spun faster and faster, and not all of it fell into the sun. Some of it circulated around the primitive sun in a dusty disk. The dust grains accumulated into planets. And all this took place, the planetary formation, we figure about 10 million years, really fast, because the dust grains are going to stick. You can't avoid that. And we see these disks around other young stars, and they, by the time the stars are 10 to 100 million years old, the disks are pretty much gone, replaced apparently by planets. And minor disks filled with debris from their collisions, which we have.
So what is it that makes the stuff come together to form planets? Is it just sort of sticky
on an atomic level? You take two dust grains and they'll hit and they'll stick together. And then you get them to the point where they become gravitationally stable and they start collecting others through their gravity. And the mathematics of it, the physics of it, seems to be it's impossible to avoid the formation of planets from a dusty disk.
And why are some essentially chunks of rock and others big balls of gas?
Close to the sun, it was hot. So the Earth couldn't absorb the hydrogen, which is ubiquitous, which is everywhere, but hydrogen is a very volatile gas, and the Earth was too hot to keep it. The same with water. And the inner planets turned out very dry and very rocky and metallic with refractive materials that melt at high temperatures. But you get out to Jupiter, it gets colder out there, and Jupiter could then absorb a lot of the hydrogen from the gas in the disk. It could pick up a lot of water. The satellites of the outer planets are largely water. Satellites, the smaller satellites of Saturn are 60, 70, 80% water, ice. It's just everywhere out there. And it can't form. It can't develop in the inner Earth, inner part of the Earth. There's a widely believed theory that the Earth's oceans were not formed with the Earth but came by the return of comets from the outer part of the solar system crashing into the primitive Earth that brought the water back to us after the Earth was formed. And it happens today.
As we all know, comets are like big, dirty
big ice balls.
Snowballs.
And every time one of these wet things hits the Earth, we get a little bit more water. I mean, it's just the Earth is still accumulating material by the rate of tons per day from interplanetary space. You just don't notice it. And some of it comes in the form of dust that just hit the meteors hit the upper atmosphere. They disintegrate and the dust settles down to the Earth. It's just falling like rain around you. You're hardly aware of it.
Mm-hmm. What the, I guess one of the other things when I had this conversation with the man who wrote the book about meteorites, we did talk a little bit about the thing that happened early in the 1900s with the
Yeah, it was in 1908, the Tunguska.
The Tunguska thing impact. That some people apparently think was a comet.
That's been speculated. I've seen both. I've seen people have produced evidence that it was a stony meteorite as well, or a stony asteroid. And I don't think the truth is actually known. Neither here nor there, whatever it wasn't an iron that kind that produced the meteor crater in Arizona because it blew up in the Earth's atmosphere. Apparently, it's just steam explosion as much as anything else. Mm. And the reports for the people who lived there in Siberia at the time were like it was the sun coming down to Earth. It was so bright and tremendous explosions. And people were not miles away. People were knocked down by the shockwave. Apparently, nobody was killed, but the forest was flattened for miles away from the point of impact.
It was apparently,
and it's the devastation is still there to be seen.
Many times more powerful than the Hiroshima.
Oh yes,
bomb.
Yeah, immensely so. Yeah. And I can't remember. They think the thing was about as big as a house.
The object itself.
Yeah, it wasn't all that huge.
Well, before that, when was the last time that someone ever thought that a comet might have hit the Earth? Was that a very long time ago?
I can't give you an answer to that. There's a basin underneath. It's Chesapeake Bay that has been suggested that it was a comet impact rather than an asteroid impact. But it's tough to track down something that happened tens of thousands or millions of years ago. There are lots of impact craters on the Earth. They tend to be buried by glaciation and covered over with dust and so on. O'Hare Field is built on one, partly on one. They're called the Desplaines structure. Mm-hmm. It's buried. You can tell it's there from fractured rock when you dig into it. Another one in northern Indiana. There are about 200 recognized meteor or impact craters, whether by comets or asteroids. You can't always tell. But there are about 200 of them recognized around the Earth.
Let's talk with somebody else. In Urbana, line one right here. Hello.
Hello.
Yeah.
One of the things I love about astronomy is you get to worry about things that can't possibly affect you, like how long life on Earth will last and so forth. And here's one that I've thought about for a while. I've read in a couple astronomy magazines in the past that, is it 1 million or 10 million years from now, a star is going to come very close to our own star, about one and a half light years away. Does that ring a bell at all?
There have been studies on nearby passages of stars, and I think the 1.5 light years is a bit close from what I read. The nearest one right now is about 4 light years away, but certainly you're going to get passages of 1 to 2 light years on occasion.
I think the passage I did hear was about, I think closer to 1 light year than 2 light years, and it was sort of a reassuring article saying, oh, don't worry about it, that's a really long way. But the Oort cloud we have an Oort cloud that goes out to about a light year from the sun, and if that star has its own Oort cloud, then aren't we looking at some?
It doesn't even have to have its own cloud because if it passed within a light year or so, it would certainly stir up the trillion or so comets that are out there.
Yeah.
They used to be
in
the inner solar system. They got tossed out there by the giant planets, and it would certainly stir them up and produce something of a increased comet flux onto the Earth, a comet storm perhaps.
Yep.
There are lots of things that can cause that. The Earth, the Sun has a tilted orbit relative to the plane of the galaxy, and when the Sun passes through the plane of the galaxy or close to a spiral arm, tides raised by the galaxy itself can also stir up the Oort cloud and produce a comet storm. So there are a variety of things that can do it. And yes, I think if the this mystery star, whatever it is, if you know, if one came close, it had its own cloud, yeah, that would produce some interesting effects. There is no known case of our being visited by an extraterrestrial comet, however. None. Yeah. Zero.
Oh, okay.
They all belong to us, as far as anybody.
All right.
If one came in from another, ejected by another star, which could certainly happen, it would come in a high hyperbolic orbit and be immediately recognized.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, so even though I won't be there, I should worry about two Oort clouds interacting.
Probably. I wouldn't lose a heck of a lot of sleep over it.
I'm not going to. All right, thank you.
All right, very good. Our next caller here is in Champaign. This is line two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
You might have already covered this. I didn't get to hear the first part of the program, but isn't there some unusual event happening with proximity to Mars, and where can we see Mars in the sky?
In short, no. There is a Mars is going to reach its closest point to the Earth, I can't remember, October or something like that, but it will be hardly noticeable, and not a lot brighter than it is now. There's been a email circulating around for the last few years that Mars is going to be as big as the moon.
Right.
I get these about once a month and say, no, that came from some comment when Mars had a favorable opposition a few years back when it actually slightly exceeded Jupiter's brightness, that Mars through the telescope would appear like the moon with the naked eye. And somebody misunderstood this wildly, either by deliberation or accidentally, and it's the email that will not die.
I see. Well, this time of year, where can we see Mars?
It rises now around 1:30 in the morning. You can see it if you get up around 3 o'clock in the morning and look to the east. You'll see this reddish thing. Don't confuse it with the star Aldebaran. It's brighter than that.
Okay.
Look for the brightest reddish thing you can see. That's Mars.
Okay. Also, I was going to ask, if I may, another question. Are there any of these cosmic forces or influences on and very large scale that can have any favorable impact on what seems to be a consensus, strong consensus concerning the global warming that's happening? Is there anything out there that we're not thinking of as we look down at the Earth?
The big argument is what the sun has to do with all of this, and there have been speculations by the people who don't believe in that it's a human made phenomenon, that it's the sun that's doing it. But on the other hand, the sun's the solar cycle seems to be pretty quiet right now and doesn't seem to be having a heck of a lot of effect on it. I don't know. It's possible if the sun's cycle quits for a few decades, that could plunge the Earth back into a little ice age again and offset the global warming, but that's total speculation, and you don't want to rely on that, because if that's the case and say, well, nothing's going to happen, then 50, 60 years later, the solar cycle comes back, we're then in real trouble.
Yeah. So there's no forces out there that appear to be poised to have any impact.
The closest you can get is that nobody is entirely sure what the sun has to do with long-term climate on the Earth.
I see. Okay. Great. Thank you.
All right. Thanks. I do remember, I don't know when this was. It was maybe about 2 years ago when Mars was very, very big.
Time goes by so fast, I can't remember how long ago that was. I think it was about 4 years ago.
Yes.
And yeah, Mars's orbit is fairly eccentric, and it'll be brightest when the Earth passes between Mars and the sun, because that's when Mars is closest. But the close approach at opposition to the sun varies from 35 million miles to 70 million miles, depending upon where Mars is in its own orbit. And at close approach, it can be a glorious sight. It's very bright, but it's still star-like. You can't see a disk with the naked eye. You fall far short of that. And that's when you want to look through with a telescope at it with a telescope, because you can see a little more detail on it. And with a high-end telescope, yes, Mars through a high-end telescope at favorable opposition kind of looks like the moon with the naked eye. You get about the same resolution. Mm. And that's where this silly email had its origins, apparently.
And people should look for it, and you can, at least to my eye, it does look a little rusty.
Oh, yeah. To my eyes, I tend to see things a little redder than other people, I think, because red stars just jump out at me. And you can get into wild arguments with amateur astronomers about star colors and planets. Nah, it's not red. It's yellow. And not, well, it looks reddish to me, darn. And I'm the one looking at it. If it's yellow to you, that's fine. The colors are fairly subtle, but Mars rather jumps out. The reddish color compared to its surroundings is quite noticeable. Mm. It's, I suppose, really sort of a yellowish, orangish, reddish kind of thing. It's not a brilliant hue, but there are a number of stars that look like Aldebaran and Taurus, and especially Antares and Scorpius, which is way over in the southwest now, kind of look like it, then can fool you into thinking you're seeing Mars.
Mm-hmm. All right. I have about 5-6 minutes left. We have a caller here, and I believe we'll talk with them next in Champaign on our line number one. Hello.
Yes, hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I also have to apologize. I recently just tuned in, but I was wondering if you could speak a little bit, if you haven't already, about the concepts of dark matter and dark energy and kind of why we have those concepts and how that plays into this, this whole cosmic discussion.
Well,
so I'll just go ahead and hang up and listen.
All right, thank you.
The idea of dark matter goes back to the 1930s because galaxies in clusters of galaxies are just moving too fast for the amount of matter that you could see. And by a large amount, and within our later decades, by the 60s or 70s, it was clear that the galaxy was rotating too fast on the basis of the mass tied up in stars and interstellar matter. And we gradually had to admit that there's other stuff out there, but at least 10 times the amount, 5 to 10 times the amount that you can actually see in normal matter, that there's something out there that's producing a strong gravity and you can't see it. You give it a name, it sounds less mysterious. It was called dark matter because it's dark and there's something there, but we don't know what it is because the gravitational effects are clearly present. Other than that, we don't really know anything about it. We know that it and bright matter and stars sort of track each other together. The stability of the galaxy probably owes itself to dark matter. So without the dark matter, the galaxy wouldn't exist and neither would we. So I guess you could say it's part of life itself in that sense. The dark energy comes about from the refinement of Hubble's discovery that the universe was expanding. The farther away you look, the faster things are going. You appear to be at the center, but everything is moving away from everything else. And about 10 or 15 years ago, and again, time escapes me, that we discovered that the farther away you look, as time proceeds, the expansion rate is actually accelerating and increasing, and nobody knows why. But there's got to be something making it do it, so it got the name dark energy, and we have even less of a handle on that than we do on the mysterious dark matter.
All right.
So much for the books that said, we're right around the corner and we'll know everything within just the next, if I could just get my next observing run in, we'll know everything. And then this stuff falls on your head and you wind up not knowing much of anything at all.
Isn't that just like science?
It's just like science. It makes great fun.
All right. Sycamore is next, line 4, toll-free line. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I've always noticed that the moon seems to have a wider range of excursion north to south in the sky than the sun does.
Yep.
And I know that's probably because the moon's orbit is tilted with respect to the plane of the ecliptic.
5 degrees.
Ah, that's the number I was looking for.
Slightly over 5 degrees. And this is why you don't get eclipses every new moon and every full moon, because the moon usually either goes over the sun or under it at new moon or north or south of the shadow at full moon. And it's only a couple of times a year when the moon crosses the ecliptic where you're at new or full where you're likely to get the eclipses. So they're related. The moon can get quite a bit higher, get 5 degrees higher in the sky than the than the sun. That depends on an 18.6-year precessional cycle of the lunar orbit.
That's the exact number I was looking for.
Okay.
Thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Right. Thank you for the call. We're coming down here. We have a couple minutes. You have been a teacher for a long time and still do teach, and I'm sure that some of the people who come into your class come without knowing without knowing anything, but maybe without knowing a lot about
it. Right.
That's why you take to learn. I'm just curious, is there anything that stands out in your mind as being something really goofy that people came into it thinking that was just spectacularly
not right? Well, I wouldn't use the word
right.
Goofy. I think the greatest misconception of all that you encounter constantly is that the seasons involve the distance between the sun and the earth. And it has utterly nothing to do with it. It has to do with that 23.5-degree tilt that we talked about, because when the Earth's axis is tilted away from the sun is low in the sky, and the energy from the sun has to spread itself out over a larger area of ground, and it cools off. when the axis is sort of tilted toward the sun. By that 23.5 degrees, the sun can get high in the sky. The radiation from the sun beats down at a high angle of the ground, and you get your maximum heating. There's a very minor modulation caused by the 1.5% eccentricity of the Earth's orbit, but it's lost in the fact that the oceans are in the southern hemisphere and the land masses are in the northern, and you don't even notice it.
Mm. So people come in thinking that when it's winter, it's cold because the Earth is farther away.
Or that the axis is tilted away and you're a little farther away, and that has nothing to do with anything either. It has to do entirely with that tilt and the angle of sunlight at noon. It doesn't have much to do with how long the sun is in the sky, because the sun's up, for example, in the polar winters, the sun's up for 6 months straight. And it's darn cold at the South Pole, even in the middle of summer, the polar summer. And it's because the sun's solar rays just don't have – they're hitting at a low angle, and they don't have the heating power.
Hmm. How far out have we been able to see? That is to say, how far away from our point of observation?
It's a question that has a vague answer in terms of getting to galaxies and things like that, pretty much close back to the horizon of the universe itself, you know, in 10, 11, 12 billion light years away. But even as defining what you mean by distance under those conditions becomes a little bit tricky. If you want to include the cosmic background radiation, this microwave radiation that is all around us at all times, then you're looking back practically to the birth of the universe itself, 13.7 billion years, because it was formed only a few hundred thousand years after the universe was born, or at least so go the theories that try to explain what it is that we actually see. And I think that's an important point, because these theories are not speculation. They're honest theories, mathematical theories that are an attempt to explain the observations. Without the observations, you got no theory.
Well, we'll have to stop. We're here at the end of the time. You'd like to read more about the cosmos, you might look for Jim's new book, Heaven's Touch, From Killer Stars to the Seeds of Life, How We're Connected to the Universe, by our guest, Jim Kaler. He's Professor Emeritus of Astronomy here at the U of I. The book is published by Princeton University Press. Thank you once again for putting up with my silly questions.
You.
I appreciate it very much. Support for today's broadcast comes from the City of Urbana, presenting Urbana's Market at the Square every Saturday morning starting at 7 a.m. with Illinois-grown produce, fresh flowers and plants, baked goods and food, and original works of art at the corner of Illinois and Vine Streets in downtown Urbana. Information is available at 384-2319. This is WILL, and WILL is a member-supported service of the College of Media at Illinois. We will pause, as we usually do, for news and update on the markets. We will be back. Please stay tuned.
Support for Illinois Public Media comes from Syngenta, featuring AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids, designed to give you up to 38 bushels more per acre if you have rootworms, and an average of 3 more even if you don't. More information on Syngenta's AgriSure 3000 GT hybrids is at agrisuretraits.com.
Well, the Informer report that was anticipated to come out at 10:30 this morning Central Time did, and Informer Economics estimates the 2009 U.S. corn production in its new report at 30.01 billion bushels, reflecting an average yield of 162.6 bushels an acre. The forecast for the soybean crop, 3.305 billion bushels, an average yield of 43.1 bushels per acre. But Informer expects final production of corn and soybeans to be bigger than its September forecast. Informer's final corn output estimate is 13.304 billion bushels, and soy at 3.372 billion. And here's how trade is going in Kansas City. September wheat is down 3.5 at 487 and 3/4. December down 4.25 at 502 and 3/4. March at 518 down 4.5. September wheat 450 down 7. December 476 down 9.75. March 495 and 3/4 down 9.5. September corn 307 and 3/4 down 5.5. December 312 down 7.25. March 325 and a half down 7. And July 2010 343.